You're listening to IRS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, September 15th. I'm Claire Fields from Drake University. Here's our first story. Lincoln Foundation contributes $90,000 to Omaha Symphony Bluffs Guild for School-Age Community Programming. The Charles E. Lincoln Foundation recently made a significant commitment to arts access in Southwest Iowa by awarding a $90,000 grant to the Omaha Symphony and the Council Bluffs Guild of the Omaha Symphony for educational programs and community outreach during the next 3 years, according to a news release. Educational and community outreach programs through the Omaha Symphony, now powered by the Charles E. Lincoln Foundation, feature programming designed for students from pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. The release said, in addition to educational programs, the Omaha Symphony also provides community outreach through public concerts where access to live orchestral music and the arts are limited. We've never received something of this magnitude, Council Bluffs Guild President Kelsey Stupfeld said of the grant, which will be doled out in $30,000 chunks over the next 3 years, during an interview with the Nonpareil. So we are very excited for our Southwest Iowa families and children on this side of the river to have more exposure to the arts and orchestral music through symphony. Charles E. Lincoln was a philanthropist dedicated to improving the well-being of others through his charitable donations and a focus on civic engagement. The vision and drive he embodied helps to secure and safeguard the future of those in need for many generations to come, according to the news release. His foundation's commitment to the children and families of Southwest Iowa ensures that everyone has access to the arts and live orchestral music. The Council Bluffs Guild of Omaha Symphony, which introduced the Omaha Symphony to the Lincoln Foundation, takes pride in supporting the symphony in efforts to introduce orchestral music to 4,000-plus Southwest Iowa students each year, the news release said. Members pledge to assist in Omaha Symphony's educational endeavors in many ways, including through volunteering, fundraising, and providing support to musicians. As the area's only professional orchestra, the Omaha Symphony annually provides educational programming and community outreach programming to more than 45,000 students, teachers, and community members throughout Nebraska and Iowa. The Omaha Symphony is a nonprofit organization that presents more than 100 live orchestral performances from September through June. In addition to Masterworks, Symphony Pops, Symphony Rocks, Movies, Symphony Jocelyn, and Family Series concerts, the Omaha Symphony's nationally recognized education and community engagement programs touch the lives of more than 40,000 people each year. For tickets or more information regarding the Omaha Symphony and upcoming educational opportunities, those interested are encouraged to call 402-345-0606 or visit omahasymphony.org. Governor may lift bar closure order next week. Governor Kim Reynolds indicated Friday she may take early action next week to lift her order that closed all bars, taverns, breweries, and nightclubs in 6 counties due to spikes in coronavirus cases. The governor last month invoked a new public health emergency proclamation that closed businesses serving alcohol in Blackhawk, Dallas, Johnston, Linn, Polk, and Story counties until at least September 20th. Restaurants in those counties that serve alcohol were allowed to remain open but had to stop serving alcoholic beverages after 10 p.m. Reynolds said the action was required to slow the spread of COVID-19, especially among the people in the 19 to 24-year-old range. It's not an easy decision to make, and it's not one that I wanted to make, the governor said during a radio interview Friday. But she said the move was necessary to address behavior that was starting to drive community spread of COVID-19, most notably in college towns where the resumption of fall semester classes was accompanied by crowds of students crowding into bars with little regard for masks or social distancing. Earlier this week, Reynolds said counties with higher COVID-19 cases had made progress in controlling the viral spread, but that she had planned to continue monitoring the trends before lifting the closure in 6 counties. I'm hoping next week the data, the trend, is moving in the right direction, and we monitor that every single day, the governor said Friday. So I'm hoping by the beginning of next week, at least, we'll have some counties, and hopefully most of them, that will be able to move off. And then, really, from there forward, try to target our efforts on the bad actors. Reynolds said she stood up a state program last week offering one-time $10,000 grants to eligible bars and taverns negatively impacted by her closure order. The Iowa Economic Development Authority is overseeing the grants as part of the Iowa Small Business Relief Grant Program, with the estimated cost at $5 million. The application window began Thursday. The governor said the stopgap funding was intended to ease the closures order's impact. Until we can get back open, and I am hoping that we can do that next week. A group of bar owners in Polk and Dallas counties sued Reynolds, arguing the governor was unfairly targeting their industry and had given them just a few hours' notice to shut down, adding to the financial strain their businesses suffered from earlier closures ordered when the pandemic took hold in Iowa this spring. A district court judge declined to issue a temporary injunction that would have allowed the bars to reopen, but he did not allow the business owners to go to trial and argue that the governor's actions are unconstitutional. Laundry Love, offering help to local residents. For the 8th year, Promise Partners is holding a Laundry Love event for people who may have trouble shelling out money to do their laundry. The event is being held from 2 to 7 p.m. Thursday at Wash Days Laundromat, 3558 West Broadway, a frequent venue for Laundry Love sessions. Quarters, soap, and dryer sheets will be provided, and guests can do their laundry in a clean, safe environment, according to a flyer. The Human Services Advisory Council is a co-sponsoring the event. It's a moving experience to see everybody that comes through, said Jessica Raymond, Community Impact Coordinator at Promise Partners. Everybody is always so gracious and thankful for what we're doing. With COVID-19, people are struggling, and we think it's going to be a really big need this year. Wash Days is a pretty big laundromat and has hosted many Laundry Love events, Raymond said. They've been a pretty good partner to us in the past, she said. Some years we've done more than one location. Last year we were out at Glenwood. Promise Partners often has two locations going at once during Laundry Love events in Council Bluffs, Raymond said. We usually have a good number of volunteers and some other partners that come alongside so we can actually do that, she said. Participants will be given a goodie bag on their way out that includes personal hygiene products, information on community resources, and a gift card to a local eatery or grocery store, Raymond said. There is a limit to 2 loads per person. Those interested can reserve a time at tinyurl.com/laundrylove2020. A reservation reduces wait time and helps allow for social distancing, she said. Walk-ins will also be accepted. As of Monday, 25 people had registered. Raymond estimated up to 125 people could participate if every time slot is filled. Iowa Western reports staff COVID-free, student cases of the illness down. For the second straight week, none of the 700 staff members at Iowa Western Community College had COVID-19. For the week of September 6 through 12, there were no new cases among the staff and no active cases, according to school officials. For the previous week, there were no new staff cases and 2 recoveries, leaving no active cases. There were, however, 6 new cases among the college's 5,100 students between September 6th through 12th, and one recovery, with a total of 4 active cases. That's down from 12 active cases the week before. It should be noted that Friday's report, published on Saturday, from Council Bluffs Community School District, referred to the total number of active cases, not just new cases. As of Friday, the district had a total of 3 active cases among staff members and 6 among students, according to the district. That comprised less than 1% of the staff and less than 1% of the student population. 2 of the staff cases were at the middle schools and 1 was at an elementary school building. The district's dashboard showed there were no staff cases at either of the high schools. Among the student cases, 3 were high school students, 2 were middle school students, and 1 was an elementary child. Pottawatomie County reported a 36th COVID-19 death, a Council Bluffs man between 61 and 80 years old. Pottawatomie County Public Health said the man died Saturday. At 3 p.m. Monday, there were 1,829 cases in the county out of 19,293 tests, according to coronavirus.iowa.gov. There were 45 new cases over a 48-hour period. The state website listed 1,548 recoveries, an increase of 8. The county's 14-day rolling average positivity rate was at 8.4% Monday afternoon. There have been 74,900 positive cases of COVID-19 in Iowa out of 704,504 tests, according to coronavirusiowa.gov, with 53,417 recoveries and 1,224 deaths. There were 2 deaths Saturday, 1 Sunday, and 1 as of Monday afternoon. Enter now! Cutest baby photo contest underway. Proud parents, it's time to show off your baby for all to see through the cutest baby photo contest. The photo with the most votes will win a $100 Visa gift card. To enter, child must be younger than 24 months as of September 20, 2020. You may only submit information and personal pictures of your own children. Only 1 child in the photo is allowed, with the exception of twins. No professional photographs permitted. Only candid photos may be submitted. 1 submission per user. Photos may take up to 24 hours to be approved. Photos submitted over the weekend will be approved the following Monday. Denison woman dies after falling from motorcycle on Iowa highway. A Denison woman died over the weekend after falling from a motorcycle that was traveling on an Iowa highway. Julie Proms, of 52, was a passenger on the motorcycle driven by Craig Proms, 59, also of Denison. According to the Iowa State Patrol, Craig Proms took a sharp turn for an unknown reason and Julie Proms fell off. The crash occurred about 9:30 p.m. Saturday as the motorcycle was going north on Iowa Highway 39 in Crawford County. Former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad stepping down as U.S. Ambassador to China. Beijing. The U.S. Ambassador to China will step down early next month, ending a 3-year tenure marked by a trade war and increasingly bitter relations between the world's 2 largest economies. Terry Branstad, appointed by President Donald Trump in 2017, confirmed his decision in a phone call with Trump last week, the U.S. Embassy said in a statement Monday. It did not give a reason for his departure. I am proudest of our work in getting the Phase 1 trade deal and delivering tangible results for our communities back home, he quoted as saying at an embassy staff meeting on Monday. Word of his departure leaked out earlier in the day when his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo thanked Branstad on Twitter for his service. Ambassador Branstad has contributed to rebalancing U.S.-China relations so that it is results-oriented, reciprocal, and fair, Pompeo wrote in a follow-up tweet. China's foreign ministry said before the embassy announcement that it was aware of Pompeo's tweet but had not received any notification that Branstad was leaving. Branstad became embroiled in a recent controversy when China's official People Daily newspaper rejected an opinion column that he had written. Pompeo tweeted last week that China's ruling Communist Party refused to run Branstad's opted while the Chinese ambassador to the United States is free to publish in any U.S. media outlet. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lin, Lijian, responded that Branstad's article was full of loopholes, seriously inconsistent with facts, and wantonly attacks and smears China. The U.S. Embassy had contacted the People's Daily on August 26th about the piece, asking that it to be printed in full without any edits before September 4th. The People's Daily said in a statement posted online, Branstad, 73, is a native of Iowa and was governor of the major farming state for 22 years over two spans, from 1983 to 1999, and 2011 to 2017. In his first term, he met Xi Jinping, now China's leader, when then county-level Communist Party official visited Iowa on a 1985 trade trip. Trump appointed him ambassador after a vacancy of several months, during which the embassy's number two official, David Rank, resigned after criticizing the Trump administration's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. Soon after arriving in Beijing in June 2017, Branstad welcomed American beef back to the Chinese market after a 14-year ban, saying, I know it is a key priority of the president to reduce the trade deficit, and this is one of the ways we can do it. But trade relations quickly soured as the U.S. imposed tariffs on Chinese products and China retaliated in kind. Other disputes followed over technology and human rights, and the response to the coronavirus pandemic. Branstad joined U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin at trade talks with Chinese counterparts in Beijing in May 2019. The Phase 1 deal reached the following January represented a truce but did not address the more fundamental complaints of the American side. The U.S. Embassy statement also noted Branstad's role in the effort to reduce the flow of fentanyl from China to the United States, including a 2018 pact in which China agreed to list the opioid as a controlled substance. Branstad also made a rare visit to Tibet in May 2019, where he expressed concerns about what the U.S. called Chinese government interference in the freedom of Tibetan Buddhists to organize and practice their religion. He encouraged the Chinese government to engage in substantive dialogue with the Dalai Lama or his representatives without preconditions, to seek a settlement that resolves differences, an embassy statement at the time said. Forecast, mild Monday in the greater Bluffs area. Bluffs area residents can expect mild temperatures throughout Monday, according to the National Weather Service out of Valley, Nebraska. Highs are expected to reach about 81 degrees, accompanied with south winds of 5 to 9 miles an hour. Tonight will be mostly clear with a low around 57. This week's forecast, according to the Weather Service. Monday, mostly sunny with a high near 81, south wind 5 to 9 miles an hour. Monday night, mostly clear with a low around 57, south southeast wind to 5 to 8 miles an hour. Tuesday, sunny with a high near 83, south wind 5 to 14 miles an hour, with gusts as high as 21 miles an hour. Tuesday night, mostly clear with a low around 59, south wind 6 to 10 miles an hour. Wednesday, sunny with a high near 86, south to southwest wind around 5 miles an hour, becoming light and variable in the afternoon. Wednesday night, mostly clear with a low around 56. Thursday, sunny with a high near 77. Thursday night, mostly clear with a low around 53. Friday, mostly sunny with a high near 72. Photos, remembering 9/11 locally. Council Bluffs Fire Captain Jim Maskey hugs firefighter Jordan Pettit following the department's annual commemoration of the firefighters who lost their lives on September 11, 2001. Next, Council Bluffs Assistant Fire Chief Derek Williams listens to stories of firefighters who lost their lives on September 11, 2001 during the department's annual commemoration Friday morning. Council Bluffs Fire Department Honor Guard members stand at attention Friday morning during the department's annual commemoration of the firefighters who lost their lives on September 11, 2001. Above, a member of the Council Bluffs Fire Department Honor Guard rings the department headquarters station bell in a 3-4-3 pattern to commemorate the 343 firefighters who died while on duty on September 11, 2001. Below, at left, Council Bluffs Fire Captain Jim Maskey, right, hugs firefighter Jordan Pettit following the ceremony. Below, from right, Council Bluffs Fire Department Honor Guard members Randy Schroeder, S-C-H-R-O-E-D-E-R, Jeff Thielen, Dan Roberts, and Matt Bonnet stand at attention during the memorial. A member of the Council Bluffs Fire Department Honor Guard rings the department headquarters station bell in a 3-4-3 pattern to commemorate the 343 firefighters who died while on duty on September 11th. Members of Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps Unit IA-951 unfurl a large U.S. flag for the signing of the national anthem, a tribute to those who lost their lives in the September 11 attacks, ahead of Thomas Jefferson's homecoming varsity football game against Sauk City North on Friday, September 11th, 2020. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, September 15th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Claire Fields from Drake University. IRS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Positively speaking, a new season of opportunity and happiness. Today, I'm in my home working on the final column that I'll pen from this location, Next week, I'll write my first column from our new home. We are in a season of change and transition. I've written some part of my books or columns from every space in this home. As I walk from room to room, the memories of children, now adults, are overwhelming. I remember our first night here and how we all ended up in one bedroom as the noises of the new home settling were a bit unsettling to our senses. But our first experiences hearing a pack of coyotes howling in our front pasture sent everyone scrambling in terror into our bedroom. Pictures taken at our front door of our children's first day of school, a house full of their friends scrambling in after classes to snack and unwind. I remember every Thursday night how our home would fill with over 60 high school students, craving mac and cheese and chili dip. Arlene was director for our local high school's Campus Life / Youth for Christ program. I remember the laughter of these wonderful students still echoing through the entire place. This home has touched many lives through these last 26 years. A friend that I met on several of my book tours as I was on his radio show on KSFO in San Francisco, Rabbi Daniel Lappin once said, "I believe the lives of people leave an imprint on this earth. I feel and sense them as I travel to new locations. Important events remain. You must open your heart and mind to feel them." I know he is right. I feel the imprint of our lives together, permanently imprinted on this home and 40 acres. I hope the new owners will be open to feeling the joy left behind. A new beginning. We'll move out on Tuesday and Wednesday. As you read this, the transition from old to new will be in motion and already in place. Decisions will be made about where furniture will fit and how our new routine will flow into this unfamiliar space. The great Zig Ziglar famously said, "The greatest successes in life often happen when we change locations." Green, Sandra. Sandra A. Green, born on May 8, 1942, to parents Jake and Helen Wilson of McClelland, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, September 9th at her home in Apache Junction, Arizona, after a long and courageous battle with cancer. Sandy's life was rich in friendships. She had a way of making everyone feel special and always guaranteed a good time was had by all. Sandy also enjoyed watching college sports, playing shuffleboard and dominoes, cooking and entertaining. Most of all, she loved spending time with family, especially her grandkids. Olivia, Luke, Lucy, and Jude brought her the greatest joy. They fondly called her Jima or Jimmy. She will be missed terribly by her husband of 60 years, Terry Green of Apache Junction, daughter Joanne Crowell of Council Bluffs, Iowa, sons Scott Green of Salem, Oregon, and Richard of St. Helens, Oregon, sister Jan Mathias of Grove, Oklahoma, several brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law, many nieces and nephews, and numerous friends. Sandy wished to be cremated with a private family service at a later date. Memorials may be made to a charity of your choice in Sandy's honor. Valier Mahala Aunt Tom. Mahala Irie Valier Aunt Tom, age 94 of McClelland, Iowa, passed away on Friday, September 11th, 2020, at her residence. Irene was born on October 10th, 1925, in Oakland, Iowa, to the date John and Myra Eckert. Irene married Lynn M. Valier on December 18, 1944. Irene was preceded in death by her husband Lynn M. Valier in 2007. six brothers and three sisters. Irene is survived by her daughter, Kathleen, and Raymond Springhauer of Glenwood, Iowa. Son, Lynn D. and Bonnie of Boulder, Colorado. Five grandchildren, eight great-grandchildren. Brother Archie and Rose Eckert of Jacksonville, Florida. Two sisters-in-law, Mary Lau of Council Bluffs. Kay Valliere of Crescent, Iowa. Brother-in-law, George Head of Council Bluffs. Nieces, nephews, and other relatives. Private family graveside services. Burial, Cedar Lawn Cemetery. Family will direct memorials. Today in sports history, Aaron Rodgers throws for career-high 480 yards in 2013 win over Washington. Here's a look back at sports happening on this date in history, September 15th. 1973, Triple Crown winner, Secretariat keeps on winning. 1973, three-year-old Secretariat wins the Marlboro Cup Invitational, handicapped in the then world record time of 1 minute 45, 2-5 for 11/8 miles. Triple Crown winner Secretariat Wright leads Riviera Ridge on way to victory in the $250,000 Marlboro Cup event at Belmont Racetrack in Elmont, New York on September 15, 1973. Ron Turcotte, T-U-R-C-O-T-T-E, is up on Secretariat and River Ridge is being guided into second place by jockey Eddie Maple. 1973, Archie Griffin starts NCAA record string of 31 games, rushing for at least 100 yards. 1973, Archie Griffin of Ohio State starts his NCAA record string of 31 games of rushing for at least 100 yards, leading the Buckeyes to a 56-7 rout of Minnesota and Columbus. Ohio State's Archie Griffin picks up some of his game-high 163 yards and 30 carries during the game with Michigan at Ann Arbor, November 6, 1973. 1978, Muhammad Ali becomes first three-time heavyweight champion. 1978, Muhammad Ali becomes the first three-time heavyweight champion with a unanimous 15-round decision over Leon Spinks at the Superdome in New Orleans. Referee Lucien Joubert goes to break up a clinch between Muhammad Ali, left, and Leon Spinks in their heavyweight title match at New Orleans Superdome on Friday, September 15, 1978. Ali defeated Spinks in a 15-round unanimous decision, becoming the first man to gain the heavyweight crown three times. 2002, Sam Hornish Jr. wins his second straight IRL title. 2002, Sam Hornish Jr. wins another incredible race at Texas Motor Speedway and his second straight IRL title. Hornish, side by side with Helio Castrone Eves for many of the last 25 laps in the season-ending Chevy 500, crosses the finish line 0.0096 seconds, only a few inches ahead of another driver in contention for the season championship. Hornish wins his IRL record fifth race of the season and becomes the first driver to win two IRL championships. In this September 15, 2002, file photo, 2002 Indy Racing League champion Sam Hornish Jr. holds up his fingers signifying his two consecutive IRL championships following his Chevy 500 win Sunday, September 15, 2002 at the Texas Motor Speedway in Fort Worth, Texas. 2012 Ryan Blaney becomes youngest winner in NASCAR Trucks history at 18 years, 8 months. 2012 Ryan Blaney becomes the youngest winner in NASCAR Trucks history at 18 years, 8 months, taking the caution filled race at Iowa Speedway in his third series start. Blaney, son of Spirit Sprint Cup driver Dave Blaney, breaks the age record of 20 years, 18 days, set by Kyle Busch in 2005 at Charlotte. Ryan Blaney smiles as he answers questions during a news conference after practice for a NASCAR Truck Series auto race at Kentucky Speedway in Sparta, KY, Friday, September 21st, 2012. 2013. Aaron Rodgers throws for career-high 480 yards in win over Washington. 2013. Aaron Rodgers throws for a career-high 480 yards, and James Jones has a career-best 178 yards, receiving in Green Bay's 38-20 win over the Washington Redskins. Green Bay Packers Aaron Rodgers throws his towel to some fans after an NFL football game against the Washington Redskins Sunday, September 15, 2013, in Green Bay, Wisconsin. The Packers won 38-20. 2013. Peyton Manning becomes third quarterback in NFL history to reach 60,000 passing yards. 2013, Denver Peyton Manning's passings for 307 yards and two touchdowns in the Broncos' 41-23 win over the New York Giants. Manning becomes the third quarterback in NFL history to reach 60,000 career passing yards, joining Brett Favre and Dan Marino. Denver Broncos quarterback Peyton Manning, 18, shakes hands with his brother, New York Giants Eli Manning, after an NFL football game Sunday, September 15, 2013, in East Rutherford, New Jersey. The Broncos won the game 41-23. 2017. Cleveland's 22-game winning streak stopped by Kansas City Royals. 2017. Cleveland has its AL record run stopped at 22 straight games as the Indians are beaten 4-3 by the Kansas City Royals, who become the first team to conquer the defending league champions since August 23rd. The Indians came within four of matching the overall record held by the 1916 New York Giants. Cleveland Indians' Francisco Lindor, left, slides safely into second base for a steal as Kansas City Royals' Whit Merrifield is late with the tag in the fifth inning of a baseball game, Friday, September 15th, 2017, in Cleveland. Aging Elvis. Back issues, questions about future as Texas SS. Elvis Andrus was once that kid for the Texas Rangers, the 20-year-old shortstop whose big league debut forced one of the franchise's most popular players to change positions. Andrus is now 32 and his 12th season is done because of lingering lower back issues. that has raised questions about his future as shortstop of the Rangers. At a time when they were taking an extended look at so many of their young players. I have done it, and I have more experience. If I get my body 100%, I'm there. I have no limitations in my mind that I can still be a productive player, Andrus said. I know there is a lot left in my tank, and I am not done. I know a lot of people want to see me go away, but not yet. The longest tenured Texas player and the only one remaining from the franchise's consecutive World Series appearances a decade ago is still owed $28.5 million over the next two seasons. But he has to be healthy and better at the plate. When asked if he saw Andrus as the starting shortstop for Texas next season, manager Chris Woodward responded that he didn't know. I love what Elvis has done in his career. I guess we'll have to see. He has to be healthy. He has to feel good. Woodward said, I would love that if he came in ready to play and playing well. That's more up to him. Andrus was placed on the injured list for the second time this year between games of a doubleheader after playing the first game Saturday. Sheraton Apostle then got called up and became the eighth different player, the fourth position player, 22 or younger, to make his big league debut with the Rangers in this abbreviated season. Another 22-year-old shortstop, Anderson Tejeda, though he never played above Class A before this season. In his 29 games this year, Andrus hit .194 with three home runs and had a .969 fielding percentage that was his lowest in 10 seasons. All three homers came in his eight games after coming off of his first stay on the injured list September 1st. While he has dealt with lower back issues throughout his career, Andrus said, it got worse and worse, and was a different pain this year. That will now be treated with injections instead of surgery. He described inflammation in a tendon that would cause pain throughout his back. It's just one thing causing another thing causing another thing. And it is noticeable this year, especially the way I was playing. I look a lot slower, he said. It takes the whole game away, and that's what it's been like for me this year. I haven't been able to concentrate just on the game. I have to concentrate on being able to play nine innings. And I'm too young to think that way right now. When Andrus made his big league debut at the start of 2009, the Rangers moved Michael Young, then 32 himself, to third base after he had been an all-star shortstop the previous five seasons. Young is still the team's career leader, and Andrus is second on the list for games played, at bats and triples. Young is also the career leader for hits and runs, with Andrus third in both of those categories. Young was a full-time third baseman for only one season. In 2010, when the Rangers went to their first World Series, before acquiring Adrian Beltre, Young was the designated hitter and played all four infield positions in 2011, when Texas won another American League pennant. Andrus said, for sure, he's still a starting shortstop, and he wants to keep playing and retire with the Rangers. I have done that my whole career. I think I've earned that, he said. No doubt I am an everyday player right now. But what about a position change for Andrus? That could be a possibility. I mean, obviously he's athletic enough where he can play. I'm guessing third or second, Woodward said. If he continues to make strides with the bat and he hits and he is going to force our hand. He's been around so long. There's so much you can depend on. If he's having quality at-bats, you can depend on the glove. Stars in Stanley Cup Final after being outscored and outshot. The Dallas Stars were mirrored in a 6-game losing streak when the season was paused for 4.5 months because of the coronavirus pandemic, and have been outscored and outshot since getting inside the NHL bubble. Yet now they are one of only 3 teams still playing, already set for their first Stanley Cup Final since 2000. "We're finding ways to win right now, and that's all that matters," Captain Jamie Benn said. With their captain and 2 rookies scoring goals in another comeback, the Stars wrapped up the best 7 Western Conference Final in 5 games with 3-2 overtime victory against the top-seeded Vegas Golden Knights. "We're not going home," goaltender Anton Khudobin screamed after his 34-save performance in the clincher. From their miserable 1-7-1 start to the season way back in October, to an unexpected coaching change for off-ice issues in December, after they were back on the winning track, and then that 0-4-2 span into March, these Stars still have a chance to win their 2nd Stanley Cup championship. Tampa Bay took a 3-1 series lead over the New York Islanders into Game 5 of the Eastern Conference Final on Tuesday night, also in Edmonton. Dallas trailed 2-0 in the opening seconds of the 3rd period, Monday night, and finally got on the board with Ben's goal midway through the period. Joel Kivrenta, whose overtime goal in Game 7 of the 2nd-round clincher over Colorado capped his hat trick, then tied the game with 3 minutes and 47 seconds left. Denis Gurinov scored the game winner on a 1-timer during power play 3 minutes and 36 seconds into overtime. "We've done this all year. We've come back from behind all year," interim coach Rick Bounds said. Down 2-0, there was no panic. "We were just a very confident group that could respond to the challenge." The final against the Golden Knights marked the 5th time this postseason Dallas came back to win when trailing after the 1st period, and the 3rd time to win when trailing after 2 periods. The Stars have also won 6 games after giving up the 1st goal, 2 short of the franchise record set by their 1999 Stanley Cup winning team. They are 5-0 in overtime, and 10-1 in 1-goal games. The Stars finished the Western Conference Final with 118 shots on goal, 48 fewer than Vegas had in the 5 games. In their 21 postseason games overall, they have been outscored 6-4-62, making them the first team to enter the Stanley Cup Final with a negative goal differential in the postseason since 1968 St. Louis Blues. "We're a confident group," Tyler Seguin said. "There's no panic. There's composure. There's just knowing that we're going to get the job done. And it starts one shift at a time. And we have key goals at big moments. And everything's falling into our favor right now. We just have to keep going." The 65-year-old Bowness, who joined the Stars as an assistant coach before the 2018 season, became the interim head coach in December after second-year head coach Jim Montgomery was fired. Montgomery, who took the Stars to the 2nd round of playoffs and a double overtime Game 7 loss to eventual Stanley Cup champion St. Louis in his only full season, later entered alcohol rehabilitation. "Bones is a big part of this team," Ben said. "It's been a crazy year for all of us. and I'm sure especially him. When the Stars beat the Nashville Predators 4-2 before a crowd of 85,630 outdoors at Cotton Bowl Stadium in Dallas on New Year's Day, Bounds enjoyed Pat Quinn and Scotty Bowman as the only coaches in NHL history to be on the bench in parts of 5 decades. Bounds is now in his 3rd Stanley Cup final in 10 seasons, his first in charge. He was on Tampa Bay's staff 5 years ago when the Lightning, a potential opponent this year, last made it with Vancouver in 2011. "It's a feeling you can't describe," Bounds said, "and you only get so many cracks at going to the Stanley Cup finals, and you've already got to take advantage of it. For me, as a coach, it's just gratifying for the players. They have worked so hard." And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, September 15th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or an Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Claire Fields from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
This is Tom Hatton with an Iris short take from the book A Culinary History of Iowa, and the first article we're going to read from the book is entitled Exploring Iowa. Located in the heart of America, Iowa is the land between two rivers, a region of the Midwest distinguished by a surprisingly rich, diverse cultural and culinary history. Between the forests of the eastern United States and the grasslands of the Great Plains to the west, Iowa's gently rolling landscape extends westward from the Mississippi River, which forms the state's entire eastern border. The Missouri River forms the western border, making Iowa the only U.S. state with two parallel rivers defining its borders. Rivers were the early highways, bringing explorers, trappers, traders, and settlers to the Iowa prairie. Centuries before the Europeans arrived, however, various Native American tribes, including the Sac, Fox, Sioux, Iowa, Meskwaki, and others, lived, hunted, and farmed across the region. The meaning of the name Iowa depends on who you ask. Traditionally, it has been described as an Iowa word, meaning the beautiful land, although others say that Iowa itself is the French spelling of Iuawa, a name meaning sleepy ones, a name given in jest to the Iowa tribe by the Dakota Sioux. Living off the land defined the food and farming traditions of the tribes like the Iowa, whose history is carefully recreated at Living History Farms in Urbandale. Iowa farmers raised corn, beans, melons, and squash. Women did the farming in the Iowa culture, while men were responsible for hunting and making tools. Iowa families were subsistence farmers, raising just enough for their family to survive throughout the year, and having a little put away in case of a bad year. The Iowa had separate summer, winter, and traveling lodges. Bark houses called nachachi kept the Iowa cool during hot summer months, while winter mat houses called chakiruta, made from layers of sewn cattail leaves, protected the Iowa from harsh winters and stayed around 50 degrees inside. While traveling on hunting expeditions, the Iowa lived in a chibo thraji, or teepee made from buffalo hides. Their villages also contain sweat lodges, food drying racks, cooking areas, work areas, hide scraping rocks, pottery pits, and gardens. At Living History Farms, historical interpreters at the 1700 Iowa farm discuss hunting, hide processing, fur trading, tool making, gardening, food processing, and the roles that Iowa men and women played in each. Interpreters use both recreated bone and stone tools and reproduced trade items to perform daily tasks. By the era of the 1700 Iowa farm depicted at Living History Farms, the first Europeans had seen the land that would become Iowa. Had history taken a different course centuries ago, Iowans might be known for their unique brand of French cuisine with a distinctly Midwestern flair. In the late 1600s, European explorers began paddling up and down the Mississippi River, passing along Iowa's eastern border. The first to visit Iowa were Frenchmen. Louis Joliet led a crew accompanied by Father Marquette, a Catholic priest. In 1673, the expedition arrived in the area that includes Pikes Peak State Park near the Iowa town of McGregor. It would be almost 150 years after Marquette and Joliet sailed along Iowa's eastern border before white settlers began moving inland to farm Iowa's incredibly rich topsoil. In the meantime, trappers and traders began exploring the rivers that fed into the mighty Mississippi. The French established some trading posts that would grow into Midwestern cities, including St. Paul, Minnesota, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, and St. Louis, Missouri. In the 1780s, a young Frenchman named Julien Dubuque learned that there were rich deposits of lead ore on the west side of the Mississippi River near Prairie du Chien. Lead was valuable because it was used to make ammunition for guns and cannons. Dubuque lived among the Native Americans in the area and mined the ore. Dubuque set up lead mines near the location of the city that bears his name and lived in the area until he died in 1810. And that was an excerpt from A Culinary History of Iowa by Darcy Doherty, Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.